This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton. Welcome back. There's a newish psychiatrist in town, Dr. Josh Mitchell from the Park City Hospital, joins us the show today to discuss the many therapies he uses to treat his patients, from mindfulness therapy, existential therapy, to electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, the importance of diet and exercise in maintaining mental well-being and in the treatment of mental illness. He moved to Salt Lake City in 2013 to start his residency in psychiatry at the University of Utah. During residency, he pursued further learning in global mental health and developed specific interests in the management of treatment-resistant depression, bipolar, and substance use. Dr. Mitchell, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much. I'm excited and pleased to be here.
It's great to have you here. That is a very impressive resume, for sure. Many multisyllabic words. Help us, especially a layperson like myself, to understand a little bit about existential therapy and ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy.
So the basis with existential therapy is largely trying to face these rather nebulous, looming crises that we all face in our lives, loss of loved ones, meaning and purpose, what we choose to do with our lives, death are very common crises that we face, and loneliness that all humans unfortunately will face from time to time, and how to kind of work through those transitions or challenges as they can profoundly impact our mental well-being, certainly large risk factors for depression, anxiety, or other mental illness. So very helpful to sit down and process and try and explore those ideas is largely the basis we work with in that regard. And then electroconvulsive therapy has been around a long time. It is also called shock therapy or shock treatments, and quite a polarizing treatment as it's been portrayed in pop culture and movies, media, in quite negative ways, where patients are being held down against their will, and electricity being applied through electrodes to the brain while they're still conscious. And that really is not at all accurate of what we see or experience in the clinical setting. We use general anesthesia. There's an anesthesiologist present to put the patient under general anesthesia, not conscious sedation. So they are completely out, give a paralytic agent, and then we do induce a seizure. That really is the treatment, and it is the best treatment we have for depression. So again, it's been around for decades, since the 50s, and hasn't changed a whole lot. There have been some modifications of the electric current and amperage that we apply, but by and large, it is still the same treatment, and the data continue to be impressive over the decades that it really is the best response rate for depression, especially treatment-resistant depression, if people have been on several different medications and not had sustained or lasting benefit from them. It does have a response rate of 70%, which is much higher than most conventional antidepressants or other medications. But again, there's a very big apprehension, I guess I would say, of wanting to pursue that treatment. It is quite time intensive, and then some cognitive changes. People often feel very tired and forgetful. Memory issues can be a bit of a concern with ongoing treatments, but it is a very effective treatment for depression.
Wow, that sounds like quite an array of tools in your tool belt to work with many of the clients that you have.
Correct, and that really, I think, is an important emphasis with behavioral health in general, that it's a challenging field. It's very complex. We don't fully understand the brain compared to other organ systems. It is still an elusive organ system to understand, but all the more reason for a comprehensive and wide array of tools. So not just medications, not just therapy, but incorporating really all aspects of one's lifestyle if possible. And I have become definitely a bigger proponent of sleep, nutrition, exercise, social support. I mean, things that we kind of take for granted or often don't spend a lot of time thinking about each day really are important staples of not only mental wellness, but treatment of mental illness.
It's the 3-pound universe, I've heard. Is that correct in regard to the brain?
Yeah, I haven't actually heard that expression, but I like it. That is a never-ending adventure or journey, I guess, to explore, right? It really is a universe in and of itself, so...
I like that saying, but I heard your brain is 4 pounds, Pete.
Yeah.
It's very light and
rumor
fluffy.
Rumor has it. Yeah.
I've eaten a lot of, what are those Easter marshmallow things?
Oh, yeah.
Peeps. I've had way too many.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Josh Mitchell from the Park City Hospital, psychiatrist there. And how long have you been at the hospital?
Well, I'm technically at the Round Valley Clinic right next door. I mean, same location, parking lot area. So, I have been working there since the end of June, so a couple of months now, feeling pretty well settled. Very, very excited to be in the Wasatch back, and I think just as need goes, there's really a lot of need for behavioral health or mental health services, and yeah, trying to fill that void or help reach people that need that assistance and help is very exciting. So everything has been going quite well, adjusting, acclimating to life with IHC through the Park City Hospital and Round Valley Clinic, and lucky to have moved up to Park City, and certainly I'm enjoying that for the outdoor life, and the small community, close-knit feel has been very, very nice and welcoming.
You look like an outdoorsman. That was part of your bio, was that, right, that you love the outdoors.
Correct. I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a place of spectacular natural beauty. Parents were very into athletics, cross-country skiing and biking, so developed an appreciation for those at a young age, and swam in college down in Ohio, and then just continued to enjoy exploring new sports, mountain biking and skiing. That was a big reason to move out west for my training. It's a good balance, and again, something I very much prioritize in my personal life as well as try to bring into clinical practice and working with people, how to get people living a healthy life, being active, being healthy with food choices and healthy relationships, and not eating too many peeps, you know?
We'll talk later.
Yeah.
So it's very heartening to me, Dr. Mitchell, to see that in psychiatric care, you're now looking at things like mindfulness, like sleep, as you say, diet, all these things playing in. And what it signals to me in general about the medical field, at least how it should be forwarding, is that you're no longer in silos, that you're saying it's a holistic approach to mental health. I'm wondering how widely accepted that is with your patients. You know, when people come in, they're suffering from this, that, or the other. Are we moving away from saying, just give me the pill to fix it, instead of saying, what's this whole program that I ought to be on?
Great question. And I would say we're in that transition period where because of the structure of our healthcare system, we still do exist in silos to many degrees, and that can be quite challenging or frustrating. But at the same time, there certainly is more awareness of the need for comprehensive care, that all of these aspects of life and wellness are closely interconnected and integrated. So approaching care from that standpoint and perspective is of critical importance. So it's certainly seeing more patients buying into it, that a single medication isn't going to just take away my anxiety. Do still certainly see a bit of that kind of, I think, clinging or wishful thinking with the power of medications, but they're really only one slice of in the pie of, you know, the whole treatment plan, and it is really hard to overemphasize. I'm not sure you can, in fact, overemphasize the importance of healthy lifestyle behaviors such as adequate sleep, healthy nutrition, physical activity, and exercise. And those are things that, unfortunately, our culture just doesn't really value that well. And we talk about them now more than we have, but the reality is there's still a lot of distracting technology or just busyness in our lives that make it difficult to really adhere to healthy routines and practices on a daily basis.
Yeah. You know, looking at something like ADHD, there was, it seems like, a very widespread prescribing things like Adderall and Ritalin.
Correct. Yes.
And And it seems now the trend is sort of to pull away from that in the beginning and see what other things we can do. Well, like mindfulness. But when you treat someone, how do you first evaluate? And then how do you decide what the best treatment should be?
Wow, very good question. Thanks. I really do like to kind of start and emphasize the social history, certainly delve into a little bit of, you know, childhood and past experiences and upbringing, but just the context and the situation that each of us are in really impacts our well-being and recognizing particular stressors. So again, those existential dilemmas, how much they might be impacting one's struggle with depression or anxiety or bipolar disorder, relationships, how satisfying work is, or, you know, if they're unable to work, what are they doing with their time? So really trying to just get a synopsis and an overview of what an individual's day-to-day experience is like is a great foundation. And then from there, try and delve into more history and timeline to help kind of recognize diagnostically what we're really working with here. And that's a cool, fun interaction and conversation. It really is the mentally stimulating part of my job because we don't have neuroimaging and lab studies to help diagnose psychiatric illness. So a lot of it does come from that history and people's reports and that timeline. So really trying to dial in there to help kind of make sure we know what we're treating here and what the key stressors are that are perpetuating the illness, or making it more difficult to find wellness or sustain wellness, I guess would be my general approach.
I feel like we could talk for hours here, but I was a previous philosophy major, and the idea of existential treatment, I really would love to understand a little bit more about what does that look like, other than reading Heidegger, or, you know, so forth. What do you recommend, and what does that look like?
To be honest, I'm not that experienced with it. I'm not a psychologist and haven't studied a lot of existentialism independently. I wish I would have done more philosophy in school. Honestly, it's such a fascinating topic. But again, how we induce our own suffering or just experience so much suffering when we are challenged by these phases of life and crises, and how we work through them or struggle to navigate them is a big factor, in my opinion, of how our overall well-being is and how those challenges impact our depression, perpetuate it, or again, for anxiety, really any DSM diagnosis that I work with. So alcohol or substance use would certainly correlate there as well. PTSD, and again, really anything across the board. But ultimately, it's, I think, coming back to that large picture of meaning and purpose, right? Such an abstract idea that we are born into this world without our choosing, and there's no play-by-play guidebook or directions and rules, really, of what to do. And so we can easily get lost in that space, especially, again, with all the distractions in our culture, making it hard to really sit with that discomfort of, right, the kind of vacuum in space that human existence is, that doesn't have a clear purpose and direction. That we have to create that for ourselves in some degree. So just being able to have those types of conversations, delve into people's goals, motivations to help kind of resolve some of that baggage, I guess, is my main emphasis, which is consistent, I believe, with existential therapy, but
right.
I probably don't go a whole lot further than that, to be honest.
So it's a reframing of our perception of that reality. Would that be a oversimplification?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Finding how we fit into this large, chaotic universe.
Okay.
And what is important to us, things that give us meaning and purpose that we want to continue to strive for.
Interesting. I'm curious about, there's been a lot of discussion about altitude and elevation and its implications and impact on depression here in our community. Talk a little bit about, do you see this as a factor? Is it something we should have some consciousness about?
I certainly think it's an interesting aspect of theory and risk factors for depression. Actually, I'm more familiar with the concerns of altitude in utero or as a fetus and being a risk factor for autism spectrum disorder. But I was just at a meeting this morning when some of the other providers were talking about the potential role of altitude in the development of depression. And I haven't read a lot in the literature on that topic or have a very good sense of quantifiably how significant that risk is. Certainly it does make sense if you're having some chronic low-grade hypoxia or inadequate oxygenation to the brain that circuits would not be functioning optimally, but I think that's still a long ways from being well understood or a clearly defined risk. But it certainly does seem very reasonable, I think, that that would be a risk factor, and it seems to fit with high altitude communities, not just here, but globally.
So not conclusive evidence that I need to go buy a hypoxia tent at this point in time.
Yeah, I think you can hold off on that for now.
All right.
Well,
might be helpful for other reasons, maybe, but...
gets my wife away from me. She doesn't like my snoring anymore.
So. Yeah. Well, and it back to your point about how... And we are learning more and more about the value of a good night of sleep. But many people who live at altitude say they sleep so much better when they go down to sea level. Mm-hmm. And so that can be all part of one, just one of the many pieces of the mental health puzzle. So let you go, I've got to ask you quickly, the Mental Health Alliance here in the community is very active in promoting mental health. I'm sure when you moved to Park City, you said, wow, that's amazing how much they're already doing around mental health.
Exactly.
How can a psychiatrist, how can you, Dr. Josh, contribute to the Mental Health Alliance in that kind of conversation?
Well, certainly being available for patients that are willing to meet with me individually and for care on a long-term basis, and through opportunities like this, helping promote the importance of mental health, wellness, and collaboration and coordination with these other services. There really is a lot going on in the Wasatch back to help improve access to behavioral health, mental health care, and support, both of which are absolutely paramount and crucial to helping a community stay healthy. And so I feel like I'm a cog in that wheel, and there are a lot of other services with more funding and more enthusiasm from the community to help. And again, just exciting to be a part of it and trying to help in any way I can. But my favorite thing to do is really the clinical work, meeting individually with clients and kind of sussing through these challenges and where they're at in their lives and how to help get them back on a stable, healthy lifestyle track.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell, for joining us today and educating us and our community on how we can live and enjoy our community even better. So,
yeah, there really are a lot of wonderful resources out there. So certainly want to encourage people to reach out if they are struggling and having issues with anxiety, depression, or suicidal thoughts, substance use. I mean, there really are a lot of people that care and want to help. So really appreciate you guys having me on the air, and it is great to be here. Thank you so much.
Great to meet you.